My deep appreciation of theater history was instilled in me by Tom Empey, a college mentor to me and hundreds of others. While teaching Greek theater terms, he would grab the fabric of his slacks and say, "You see these pants? Euripides, Eumenides," making light of content that could be considered rather dry and stuffy while still maintaining respect for the art, which is what I want to do with this podcast. For each episode, I invite a guest from the many paths my theater career has taken me down. I give my guest no idea what we'll be talking about, but they know we're going to find an outrageous story about theater history and perhaps get a better understanding about why we're still doing it after all these years. So welcome to Euripides Eumenides, and I am your host, Aaron Odom. Apocalypse, I said, why you wanna show up now? Just when the heart of my life was getting good. I'll give you one more chance. Walk on out of the door, yeah. Get your ass to getting where the getting is good. Good morrow, Eumenidites. This is Aaron Odom from Trident Theater, bringing you another episode of Euripides Eumenides, a theater history podcast. My listeners, I gotta say that I appreciate the challenge of finding stories for you to hear every 2 weeks, and this was something that was brought up to me when I first started this show. A lot of people I consulted on the idea of doing a theater history podcast all said the same thing. Do you think you can find enough topics to talk about? Well, it turns out, yes. Yes, I can. In fact, the process of researching for the show has given me great opportunities to look at a lot of theater history, not just through an academic light, but rather, it has allowed me to enjoy things that I may have otherwise only come into contact with through my formal training or to teach in different formats. Instead, now, I'm doing it for fun, and it's allowing me almost more perspective into theater history than could be provided by textbooks or critical essays. Now, this episode gave me some fantastic opportunities. For this episode, I pore over a play that I wrote many papers on in my graduate studies, even my final culminating project. Playwright Harold Pinter always eluded me throughout my studies until I studied him for my master's. And while I came to appreciate his work much better through the lens of academia, studying Pinter's play The Homecoming for this episode was a truly devilish treat. The other opportunity it gave me was to connect with a great friend from college, Suzanne Katsakis. Suzanne and I were in the same graduating class together and were frequently seen partners in classes. Suzanne is a Los Angeles-based actor with many different branches in her career, but I'll let her explain that in the episode. But I can truly say we had an absolutely marvelous time dissecting this play. So, without further ado, here's today's episode, Play Spotlight, The Homecoming by Harold Pinter. Avada, 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 avada. Suzanne, we just were reminiscing that it's kind of nice to be at an age where we can say, I haven't seen you for 20 years, but Suzanne, I haven't seen you for 20 years.
I literally said to you, I can't believe I'm at the age where those are the kinds of things I'm saying all the time. That and like, wow, my knees really hurt when I stand up.
I can tell when a storm's coming. But it sounds like you have been doing a lot of really cool things. I mean, took a break from acting for a while, got back into it, been in New York and LA, but now you find yourself doing a lot of like voiceover work and sketch comedy and stuff. That's pretty cool. So what's going on with that?
Thank you. I mean, it definitely has been fun and amazing. Obviously, a pandemic happened, so live theater, as we know it, went a little bit awry. But I think things are starting to, and then we just came off of a strike. So things has been a slog if you are a creative or an actor, which is why you should always have a day job. Some way, right. Freelance work. I mean, yeah. Many people are lucky to not have to. I am not at that point yet. But yes, I have been doing voiceover and TV and some film and then just like writing children's books.
That's right.
Also not my day job.
No, No, but those passion projects. I mean, we talked about that on the last episode, like Orson Welles and his Chimes at Midnight, this great passion project. But you've got these fun children's books called Mutasia?
It is Mutasia, yeah. It's a children's book series, a fantasy series, where all the characters are mixed up mixes of two or more different animals. And our main character's name is Figgly. And kind of the themes we work through are friendship, individuality, and all kind of through a lens of humor. And, you know, we're all 80s, 90s kids, so kind mm-hmm. of reflects a little bit of our, I don't know, the things we loved as kids.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I saw some imagery from it, and it was very reminiscent of, like, children's books that I had when I was growing up, so that was kind of cool. Yeah. But, you know, that reminds me, like, I was so dead set against the Shrek musical when I first heard about it. I mean, so many reasons. I've talked about it on the show several times. I'm like, it's so, you know, for small businesses, it's so difficult for them to be able to meet the demands that the script has, because it's this huge Broadway show. When people are like, oh, we're going to do Shrek, I'm like, how are you going to do the dragon? Tell me how you're going to do the dragon. And then I saw it on Netflix, and I was totally sold. I'm like, okay, this is kind of cool. But then the whole message of that show became, let your freak flag fly. Nice. And I just think of how many kids, like you were saying, 80s and 90s kids, had that message of you're an outsider, or you are into, I don't know, tabletop gaming, and that makes you weird, or you're in a cult, or whatever the hell.
Yeah.
And now we've got all these people going, no, all of these things just make you unique, and that's not bad. Gosh. So that's awesome.
It's a wonderful thing. I mean, I remember that I was considered a tomboy growing up because I played sports and loved video games, like, which I still do. And I remember it was so like, you're one of the friends, like, you know, I remember when I was little, and there was, this is very little, obviously, but there was a game of kissing tag going on. And I remember being like, oh my gosh, like, this is, someone's going to chase me. And then all my guy friends were like, help us get this person over here. Okay. Anyway, it's cool to be a nerd now, and I love it.
Oh my God.
That's the short.
Oh man. Well, I don't know how this keeps happening to me, but Suzanne, that is a really wonderful transition into what we're going to be talking about today. I'm very, very excited. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. So my listeners who have already seen the title of this know what we're going to be talking about. But Suzanne, I have a question for you.
Okay.
In plays or movies or TV or whatever, what is a great example you can think of a power play? Okay. Like somebody trying to gain power over somebody else.
Okay. So here's, it might be very weird. I know that probably post this podcast, I'm going to come up with millions of ideas that really fit into this. But the two ideas, I'll start maybe with the less weird one, which was the first thing I thought of, which I don't know if this counts, but I was thinking of Doubt, the play Doubt. I was thinking of the whole storyline there. Is it Sister Nation? I can't remember.
I can't remember her name. The main nun who's doubting
the
her
main
faith.
Nun. Aloysius? Nope. Okay. Anyway.
Something like that.
I should know this. and I was thinking of that as a one form of power play. And then I was thinking of, well, is there a reverse power play where someone expects you to not be strong and then is taken out by the fact that you are strong? And I just kept thinking of The Last Unicorn, which is a very old animation. One of my favorite animations from my childhood, because the Red Bull did not expect, you know.
Right.
Expect her to fight back. Spoilers, everyone. Very, very new animation from 1984.
Yeah, something like that. Oh, that, I mean, I don't mean to laugh, but that's beautiful. That actually is really, really great.
Is it?
Where you like, you didn't see this coming, but the unicorn is the powerful one. That's outstanding. Oh,
I'm a little weird. I don't think I'm weird, but as we said, we're at the place in our lives where we say like, oh, I haven't seen you in 20 years. I've been with my husband for 21 years and a lot of my friends for 30 years. And they have repeatedly told me over the years that the way my brain rolls is a little weird. So I embrace it.
Good. Good. Well, okay. I've got a follow-up question then. Those are great.
Oh no.
How much do you know about the works of playwright Harold Pinter?
Oh my gosh. Well, okay. one of my favorite plays is Harold Pinter. That's who did Betrayal.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. I don't actually know that much. I just know that play I know relatively well. Mm-hmm. And I know a few others, but I wouldn't say I know a lot, which is real bad considering I was a theater major.
He's out there. We'll describe it, but we're going to be describing and talking about one of Harold Pinter's plays today. But I'm going to start this out with kind of a longer quote that I got out of an essay I read. Pinter developed a dramaturgy so distinctive, it has earned the label Pinteresque. Employing a mix of familiar and indecipherable dramatic events, the Pinteresque is associated with the following elements: a sparsely furnished room, an ongoing and precarious balance of power, physical, verbal, and psychological, between the inhabitants of the room, and the entrance of an outsider who disturbs the balance, provoking power struggles that issue in a violent or near-violent denouement. There's more. Speech often reflects a need for dominance and displaces a physical violence that would break out if that need were not contained or redirected.
I love it broken down like this. I'm like, you're right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I have more. Pinter wrote, "The speech we hear is a necessary avoidance, a violent, sly, and anguished or mocking smokescreen, which keeps the other in its place. When true silence falls, we are still left with the echo, but are nearer nakedness." One way of looking at speech is to say that it is a constant stratagem to cover nakedness.
That is no joke. The rainstorm just started coming down outside.
The thunder.
Yeah.
Now you're into it. Oh my God.
That is very beautifully and a very visual, beautiful way of saying that. And
it's
also
heavy.
Terrifying and heavy and scary.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I said terrifying. That's the same.
That's okay. I think those are two actually very different things in their own sort of ways. But I mean, what it breaks down to is basically, Harold says, look, we all have these things, these huge emotions bubbling up in us. And at any moment's notice, that thin blister skin is going to pop and just start gushing out everywhere. Yeah. So we use our speech in a way to be violent yet nonviolent. Mm. Be violent without physical violence, maybe. It's really,
sure.
Woof.
It well, could be our speech can be threatening. It can be passive. It can be like dangling of, you know, we could go this way or this way. Speech is a pregnant pause of choose your own adventures.
Oh, you said the pregnant pause. We're going to be talking about the Pinter pause here in a little bit. Oh. It's fantastic. It could be felt that Pinter felt this way, though, that violence was about to erupt at the slightest provocation, because of his experiences as a youth in Europe during World War II. Born in Hackney in England in 1930, Pinter came from a long line of Polish Jews who had emigrated to England like two or three generations prior. But when World War II broke out, young Harold had to be evacuated before the German forces bombed London in the London Blitz. He soon returned afterwards to see the aftermath. So it was like he was a direct, like, it was just, you know, he was just a kid, 10 years old playing, and then they come and bomb the heck out of it. Now, as a teenager, he was adjacent to a fascist uprising in London, instigated by Sir Oswald Mosley, who had studied Mussolini's tactics and at that time believed that a fascist movement would be the only thing that could save Britain. What this resulted in was that kids were now developing gangs and wandering the streets of London with makeshift weapons, looking for Jews and communists to beat up. Post-World War II, you have these British kids who turned fascist. Now, Pinter...
Yeah, that was the right... That's the choice. That's the choice to take.
Yeah. MAGA, anybody? Okay.
Yeah.
Now, Pinter, being a Jew, fought back in his own way, with words. He and his friends would often use banter to disarm their would-be dispatchers. But this, of course, may have given him a few ideas. One, language is often a more powerful tool than actual violence. Two, people are almost always living in intense circumstances, and thus emotional outbursts are just under a thin veneer waiting to burst out. And three, most of these situations are not just in houses of parliament or battlefields. These feelings can be observed in the most domestic of situations, such as in city parks and streets, schools, or even in the home.
Oh, yeah. I would say that that lives very presently in every walk of, you don't even have to leave your door, but then you leave your door and you're constantly dealing with other, because everyone has their own stuff going on and is potentially bubbling at the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And either you are a catalyst or a diffuser of it. Yeah,
right. I tell you what, I'll go upstairs when I'm done. And my boys have been with me this weekend. And I've had a long week. I've had a lot of things going on. And I swear to God, if I see one of their socks on the floor, not in a hamper.
Deep breath count time.
It's that stuff. You're like, you cannot be telling me the socks are here.
This is an incredible breakdown of this. Well done, one. And two, I'm sitting here a little bit like, I was just really, really processing all of it because I'm like, this is so true, just as, yes, in life, but also about his plays, at least the ones that I'm familiar with. And you have distilled it down to a very eloquent list.
Excellent. Well, I think that's about all I'm going to actually explain about the life of Harold Pinter. We don't need to go too much more into his biography to understand what he does with his most well-known play, which we're going to discuss today, The Homecoming.
Oh my gosh. So here's the thing. Yes, if I have read it, it's been once. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember it at all. Because it's not the way that I work is if I haven't reread it or seen things multiple times, my husband can retain information by reading a book and he'll come away being like, just knowing all of it. I just do not roll that way. This is awesome because obviously I know the title well and I can't tell you anything about it right now.
Yes, good. That will make for a great episode. Now, I think it's also important to note a couple things just for some fun trivia and juxtaposition of some facts. First of all, the play premiered in 1965 in London. Now, that's important to note because it was a time when, like Pinter, children born around World War II were coming into adulthood, and the effects of the war were certainly showing themselves in domestic situations. But around this time, there were a few young male playwrights in England who came to be known as the angry young men due to the high levels of emotion that the characters in their plays went through as an expression of the playwright's views of the world.
Okay.
Some academics try to scoop Pinter into this group as well, but Pinter adamantly refused that he was part of the angry young men. And I wholeheartedly agree. Like, if you read those other plays, those are some pissed off young men. And yeah. Pinter always claimed that his works were more often directly inspired by the works of Samuel Beckett, who, like Pinter, gave his audience very little clues as to what was going on with the characters or their circumstances. Frankly, Beckett claimed that he seldom knew what was going on with his characters anyway.
That's an interesting way to write.
I love the way he put it when everybody was asking him about waiting for Godot. They're like, so they're waiting for God. Yes. They're waiting for God, right? And his answer every single time was, if I had known who Gatto was, I would have written it into the play.
Love it. Also, like, I don't know, sometimes I feel, I don't know, with art too, is like you write something and then when you give it out, it's for everyone else, you know?
Yeah.
And that's the fun of everyone being like, I have these things of what I think it is. And it's like, well, sometimes there's just not an answer. Sometimes it's like editing. I edited a video for many years, and sometimes something would be edited so beautifully and someone was like, the way you did that cut was amazing. And I was like, yep, except it was just a beautiful mistake. You know, it just happened to work. Yep. And I went, oh man, that looked really good. Okay, great. I'll do that. And then everyone's like, I love what you did with that. The meaning behind it is amazing. And I'd be like, mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes. It took a lot of soul searching to get there.
Amazing. Anyway, sorry. Tangent.
That's okay. Well, here's another funny thing to note. We're talking about Samuel Beckett. He's often considered the first absurdist playwright. And when someone suggested to Pinter that his plays could be considered absurdist, he would just laugh, claiming that he more often wrote tragicomedy about circumstances that most of us could probably observe on a daily basis. Now, there's something that I'm going to tell a short story about myself here. When I was first introduced to Pinter, it was kind of in this vein. And, you know, they're saying there's something under the surface here and he's not really going to tell you, but by the end of it, it should blow your mind. And I remember reading Betrayal and I thought it was really kind of cool because it goes in reverse chronological order. And it's about these two friends, and one of them is married, but the wife is sleeping with the other guy. And through the whole thing, you kind of figure it out, but they never flat out say it. And I remember, like, my instructor was talking to me about how venerated Pinter was and how respected he is in the playwriting genre. And I was thinking, like, he has just played the greatest practical joke on academics that I could ever even think of, because he's making them go, no, this means so much more. And they're like, well, tell us more. He's like, I can't. You have to figure it out.
Yes. Yes. And don't have an answer. And then you let very smart, intelligent people who fixate on it and overthink it tell you what it was.
Yeah. And at the end of it, and they go, is this what it is? And he's like, it could be. Mm. So anyway, yeah, that was my fun little story on Pinter. And then I started studying him in graduate school, and I'm like, oh, there is actually something to this.
why did you choose? I mean, I obviously, like, there's a million reasons, but I was curious, why did you choose Pinter?
Oh, well, it was actually assigned to me several times, but I kept coming back to this play, Suzanne.
Okay.
Like, this play, has so much to me to say. Like, I thought about talking to you about The Birthday Party. It's so weird. Like, it's a three-act play, and at this, there's so much aggressive banter back and forth between the characters that at the end of the second act, there's a man who tries to sexually assault a woman in a game of blind man's bluff. And it comes
I don't remember that either.
Yeah, it came out of bloody nowhere, and I'm like, what is going on? And they didn't really resolve it by the end. It was just like, okay, I guess we all have that demon living. Oh God, this is terrible.
Yeah, that's weird. Yeah, you're like, you were literally like, what was that? Can you actually answer that?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So with that, I think I'd like to get into The Homecoming to see just what Pinter is trying to say in the situation he sets up.
Let's do it.
Okay. Now, before we begin, I want to make mention of a couple things. First, here's a quote I found regarding the works of Pinter. What we lack in precise information about the characters' backgrounds and motives is made up for by a very complex knowledge, if we are alert to it, of the nature of their shifting emotions in regard to each other. So basically, we're not given a lot to go on, but if you listen carefully, you'll make some very important discoveries along the way about the characters. It's almost like getting to the end of a really well-done mystery and wanting to go back and watch it again to catch all the little things that led to the conclusion. You know what I mean?
Totally. Yes. So what he's saying is, like, things you're not told can be seen through the emotions that unfold throughout the play.
Or just how the actors are.
How
they're saying the lines to each other, the words that they're choosing to use. more specifically, the words they're not choosing to use. Yeah. Mm. Next, I need to stress just how deliberate everything in Pinter's works are. Everything he puts on the stage has a deliberate purpose. Every word he chooses has deliberate purpose, even though it may not seem like it. And finally, I would be somewhat remiss if I didn't talk about the famous Pinter pause. Pinter does have something of a mastery in speech in that he has a lot of tools in his toolbox. I think a way that I heard it was he has three levels of pauses. There is an ellipsis, which is just a short little regathering of thoughts. There is the word pause. He puts the word pause in there. And that's kind of a tool to like redirect the action or gather up what's happened and kind of come out of the shock of what might have happened. And then there is a silence, which is significant. You know, so you have an ellipsis, which might be a few seconds. A pause can be several moments, but a silence is many, many moments of just taking it all in. So the pause, the Pinter pause. Okay. You ready for the homecoming?
I'm ready. Ready for the homecoming and the three levels of pauses.
Ooh. And by the title alone, what does that suggest to you?
I mean... Someone's coming home.
Hey, there we go. Yep. And that's right. It's just on the surface. That's what's happening, right? Knowing that there's going to be some huge thing that comes out of that. Okay.
Of course.
So let's see what's meant by the cast. And this is what you get right at the beginning. This is all the information that is given to us about the characters, who they are, and their relationships to each other. Max, a man of 70. Lenny, a man in his early 30s. Sam, a man of 63, Joey, a man in his middle 20s, Teddy, a man in his early 30s, and Ruth, a woman in her early 30s.
That's it.
Names and
ages.
That's
some deep character backstory right there.
Yeah, right? You were born at a certain time.
Yeah. This is you, which, by the way, does matter. Your age does matter. Yep, how you take information in. But that also says you better read this play to get to know this person, because I'm not going to give you the cliff notes.
No, absolutely not. Now, the set basically consists of two large armchairs, a large sofa, and a large sideboard with a mirror above it. There are also apparently odd tables and chairs. The back wall has a door frame with the door removed, and beyond the doorway, a large staircase can be seen leading up. There is also a front door on stage with a coat stand and some coat hooks. That's all we got. Hmm. The play begins with Lenny sitting on the sofa reading a newspaper. He is soon joined by Max, who comes on stage looking for something. He makes it known that he wants to cut something out of the paper and suspects that Lenny has moved the scissors. And by doing so, begins an exchange that sets the tone for the whole play. For the first several minutes, Lenny only responds to Max a few times about the fact that he wants to read the paper in peace and quiet, which Max is not going to let him do. Within the first few lines of the play, Lenny says, "Why don't you shut up, you daft old prat?" And perfectly British. Pinter was so snobbily British. I loved it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Wait, so Lenny said that.
Lenny
to Max.
Said that to Max. Yeah. Yeah.
And Lenny's a 70.
Max is 70. Lenny is his early 30s.
Okay, yep. That's why I was like, wait, that doesn't make sense. Okay.
Yep.
Got it.
But now the game is on. Max proceeds to try to win this argument by taking several tactics, including threats and distractions, all of which Lenny ignores. And after each failed attempt, there is a pause.
Obviously. I mean,
in one of these attempts, Max introduces us to one of the unseen characters of the play, his old friend McGregor, who he apparently shared quite the history with. He also mentions his wife, who we come to know as Jessie, and seems to talk about her in the past tense. Lenny demands that Max remains quiet, and after a short interchange, Max launches into a sweeping monologue about horse races, as we discover that Lenny is actually reading a racing form.
A racing form?
Yeah, it's the little newspaper that they get that talks about the horses' stats and everything and who's racing.
Oh, yes. Okay. Okay. Yes. Yeah. As you can tell, I'm very into horse racing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You don't get your subscription? I mean,
I do not have it. okay. So he's not even he's just like checking stats.
Yeah. Thus, we have established that this room is nothing more than a battleground for proving one's superiority in the arena of masculinity. That's all these guys do is try to prove who's more masculine in the entire play. At point, Lenny calls Max dad. So now we have established their relationship.
Oh. Yes. Not just two guys. Okay. Yeah. Good way to unfold it.
I know, right? We are soon joined by Sam, who Lenny refers to as Uncle Sam. So now we have that relationship established. So now we know Max and Sam are brothers and Lenny is Max's son. So all this violence towards each other is happening between family members.
Which definitely, luckily not in my personal immediate family, but as I have learned through friends, is that can be where a lot of violence happens.
Right. Family members. Exactly. The most. Yeah. I was just at my mother's for a dinner and her significant other was telling a fun story about how he and his brother used to like tease their younger brother by like holding him upside down over the toilet and just getting him nervous and like getting his hair wet or something like that. Gosh. And my mother looks at me being an only child and is like, aren't you glad that you didn't have that? And I'm like, mother, I was doing that to myself. You know?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I didn't know you were an only child. I'm an only child too.
Yeah. What? Wow.
Yeah.
Kinship.
Yeah. I know. I was like, yeah, don't worry. We beat ourselves up the most. Anyway.
Yeah, exactly. That's how I became an actor. Yeah. I can only talk to myself. So, in the homecoming, after a short casual chat in which it's revealed that Sam, the brother of Max, is a chauffeur, Sam and Max then launch into a subtextual verbal battle, by the end of which Sam is accused of being homosexual due to the fact that he has never married. He's 63.
Oh, my gosh.
I know, right?
One, who cares? And two, who cares that he's not married? Either right? One, who cares?
And he's the only one that in this whole thing, we really have established that he has like a legitimate job.
Yeah. Sounds like he's doing great. So. Mm-hmm.
But Sam does acknowledge that Max's wife, Jessie, was really something when she was around.
Aww.
Yeah.
I'm like, was it death? Was it divorce? Like, which one? Maybe something else.
So soon we're joined by Joey, who reveals that he's a boxer and that he's Lenny's younger brother. And some more verbal sparring takes place as well. Now that we have a new man and we got to, the scene soon just ends with a blackout. Okay. So we've established that this place is male battleground.
Yeah.
And
it sounds exhausting.
It is exhausting.
Yeah.
When the lights come back up, all the men have left the room, but Teddy and Ruth are now standing in the front doorway. It is established that it is late at night and that everyone else in the house must be asleep in their beds. Teddy and Ruth indicate that they have traveled far and that Teddy is the oldest brother in the family. Teddy tells Ruth about the house, but also establishes Jessie, his mother, died years ago. So it's just the four men living in this house, and Teddy's room is just as he left it. Wow. Teddy and Ruth have a short interchange in which Teddy is trying to get Ruth to go to his room and stay there. But Ruth refuses, not adamantly, but to a point that Teddy can't get around. Instead, in the middle of the night, in North London, Ruth wants to go for a walk.
In the middle of the night.
Uh-huh. By herself.
Oh, by herself.
Yep.
Yeah. Don't do that. Don't do that.
No, she really wants to.
Why? I'm sure there's a very good reason.
Uh-huh. Teddy still can't win, and she eventually just slinks out the front door, followed by silence. Lenny then enters the room. Silence. And they just stare at each other.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
After a brief but somewhat uncomfortable conversation in which the two brothers catch up, Teddy takes Lenny's subtle threatening advice to go upstairs and go to bed. He does so. Lenny leaves the room but comes back out with a clock that has apparently been keeping him up and stares out the window. Ruth then returns, and after some introductory conversation, which Ruth reveals that she's married to Teddy and has been for 6 years now.
And Lenny, so Teddy went upstairs, even though it's his wife.
Yep.
And Lenny was like, you go upstairs, I'm going to sit here with a clock.
Yes. Yes. He has no idea that Ruth is even a thing.
Oh, okay. I was like, do they know? Okay, so then she comes back in, like, hi, you don't know me.
Here's Lenny, the brother, who she doesn't know is his brother. She can kind of surmise by age, I would imagine. They engage in some very sexually charged interchanges. It's all very subtle, but it's very much like, are you in? I might be in. Are you in?
They don't know. Just she walks through the door from a walk to nowhere, and the and they're just engaged in this, like, oh, hi, yes.
And they have now established that Ruth has been married to Teddy for 6 years.
This is already very unhinged.
I know. But Suzanne, this little interchange right here culminates in one of my favorite scenes in theater.
Oh my gosh.
The glass of water scene.
Oh.
Do you know about the glass of water scene?
Do you know what? No, I mean, it's one of those maybe. I don't know. It's like the Chinese food scene in Hurley Burley. I don't know. You know, I don't know.
Here we go.
Lay it on me. Maybe my theater, you know, memory will come back.
Oh, this is so fantastic. Lenny gets Ruth a glass of water, and she sits at the table with her glass. After learning that Ruth and Teddy have been taking a tour of Europe, Lenny launches into a monologue, telling a story about being recently solicited by a prostitute at the seaside. But once he realized that she must be diseased, he punched her. With no one else around, he had intentions of killing her, but in the end decided it would be too much trouble to dispose of the body, so he hit her again and left. That's the story he tells his newly found sister-in-law.
First off, what a monster. And second, like, the fact if that's true and that's what happened, what he said. And secondly, that's the story. That's the story to get to know someone you tell.
Break the ice, as it will. I've gotten you a glass of water. Hey, by the way, here's this interesting tidbit about my life.
Okay, yeah, I didn't know this then. No, definitely not. Hold on. It's not done yet? Oh, geez.
Oh, no.
Oh.
When he's done with his speech, Ruth looks at him and asks him how he knew she was diseased, completely derailing his whole thing. It was probably a totally made-up story. She just completely took the wind out of his sails.
Oh.
He then begins to compare himself to Ruth's husband, Teddy, letting us know that Teddy is a professor of philosophy back in America and that Lenny wished he could be more sensitive like Teddy. Lenny then launches into another long monologue about how he volunteered to get up before dawn many days last winter and shovel snow in a neighborhood hit heavily by snowfall. While there one day at a tea shop, he volunteered to help an old woman move an outdated laundry device known as a mangle. She was given this device as a gift, but it was placed in the wrong room and she couldn't move it on her own. Stating that he was feeling rather invigorated by the shoveling, Lenny says that he offered to help her, but that the mangle was much too heavy for him to move on his own. He also states that the old woman was doing nothing to help him. So what did he do? Spoke to her harshly, punched her in the stomach, and left.
This guy is an asshole obviously. So either these stories are true and he's just a monster maniac, or he thinks, I'm going to tell this story because this is going to turn this lady on, and I'm going to show how strong and amazing I am. And I, Suzanne, am appalled by this. And I really hope Ruth just takes him down a notch.
Well, the way I see it, like, the one tactic of showing I'm domineering and I can take control of you at a moment's notice And she's like Neo in the Matrix, just kind of moving bullets, you know?
Yes. I gotta say, I have respect for her because I feel like if I was in that position, I would be so overwhelmed and deer in headlights. I would not have the eloquence to pop the balloon as subtly as Ruth did.
Oh, man. Yeah. And then he launches into this next one where he's like, I was really philanthropic and I went to help people in need. And this old woman had this thing. And I think he sees that partway into the story, it's not sinking in. Yeah. So he goes back to domineering tactic.
Yeah. Also, I love that he's like, I really wanted to be like my brother who is more sensitive and thoughtful. Here's a story where I yell at an old woman.
And punch her. Now, this is where things get interesting. At the end of the old lady punching story, Lenny offers to move an ashtray that is sitting on the table in front of her. He explained that he's worried that either the glass or the ashtray may fall and that his father will complain if anything happens to the carpet. Ruth refuses to let Lenny take her glass and refers to him as Leonard Paws.
Ooh, that literally, she was just like, I'm taking all this crazy, overdone masculine energy, and I just turned you into a very sweet goat.
Well, Lenny obviously gets very agitated and tells her not to call him that because only his mother can call him that. He then demands she gives him the glass. She refuses. Pause.
Oh.
He says, I'll take it then, to which she replies, if you take it, I'll take you.
What does that mean?
Uh-huh. Lenny then reminds her that she's married to his brother, and this is her reply. I'm going to play the two characters here. Ruth says, have a sip. Go on. Have a sip from my glass. He is still, she says. Sit on my lap. Take a long, cool sip. And these are the actual stage directions written by Pinter. She pats her lap. Pause. Oh. She stands, moves to him with the glass. Then she says, put your head back and open your mouth. Lenny says, take that glass away from me. Ruth says, lie on the floor. Go on. I'll pour it down your throat. Lenny then says, what are you doing? Making me some kind of proposal? She laughs shortly, drains the glass, and says, oh, I was thirsty. She smiles at him, puts the glass down, goes into the hall and up the stairs.
Oh, she is a boss. That is a power play, right? That's the reverse power play. It's not quite the Red Bull and the unicorn, but, you know, he came in thinking he was going to punch his way into her, I don't know, pants. And she just coolly sipped her way up the stairs.
Took him out with a glass of water.
Wow, that was she's awesome. Sorry. I'm like, yeah. That is some.
Isn't that great?
That is amazing. I did not know. Mm-hmm. I definitely have not read this play.
Oh, it gets so much. There's so much more, Suzanne. I like, okay, here we go. Avada, 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 Avada. How about that, huh? Completely shut down by a glass of water. And my listeners, neither Ruth nor Pinter is even close to done with these characters. So if you didn't see that coming, I guarantee you, you won't be ready for the rest. But while we're stopped, I'd like to thank you for your continued patronage. I'm still loving to see where I have continued followings. I am looking at you, Germany and South Africa, and the Cayman Islands. Where did you come from? Feel free to follow the show on Instagram, or you can just drop a line to Trident Theater at tridenttheater.com using the Contact Us form. Okay, let's get back to Suzanne Katsakis and the conclusion of Play Spotlight, The Homecoming by Harold Pinter. Lenny then yells at her after she leaves, as he has no idea what to do with her. He then pours himself a new glass of water.
He's like, damn, that was...
Yeah. Max then wakes up and spars verbally with Lenny about Ray's voices and having been woken up. Lenny does not reveal to his father that Ruth and Teddy are in the house.
Oh, That is interesting.
Blackout.
Of course.
Uh-huh. In the morning, Max, Joey, and Sam have some more superiority squabbles, and Teddy and Ruth just enter the room. Max seems rather upset at first, not just because he didn't know his son was home, but rather that he assumes that Ruth is a prostitute and that Teddy brought her home for the evening.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't know that his son is married.
Oh my gosh. 6 years!
6 years!
Teddy, what is going on? Clearly, it is a homecoming.
Uh-huh. The confusion is then cleared up. Teddy reveals that they are married and are here for a few days to visit. And this seems to calm things down, and Max apparently reconciles with his son, offering him a, quote, nice kiss and cuddle like they did in the old days. And that's the end of Act One.
Wow. Damn, Pinter.
It's so tense.
It's so... Can I, like, as a digester of this information, I'm loving it. As someone who puts myself in people's shoes a lot, like, oh. I am so stressed out. Like, the anxiety, it is too much. I can't, this is great. By the way, I'm totally reading this play after this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And you will be amazed. You'll be like, the words are so sparse at times where you're like, you're just fighting about where the scissors are.
Yeah.
And it really, if you look under it, it is him going, I'm the man of the house. You are my subservient because I'm older. Do my bidding. And the other one goes, no, piss off. I could kill you. Basically.
Yeah. I can do what I want. I'm strong. I'm young and I don't need to listen to your rules anymore.
Right. Oh, God, it's something. Now, at the beginning of the second act, all the characters are on stage and they're relaxing with coffee after a lunch that Max has prepared. All the men light cigars. Very Freudian. Yes.
Just so, yeah.
Max begins to wax whimsically about his wife and how wonderful she was. But soon he remembers that Sam has a driving job that afternoon and he's going to be late. This then causes Max to launch into a tirade about how much he struggled as a butcher all his life to keep his family afloat and how he was going to join a network of butchers but didn't because they all turned out to be crooks. In this speech, he also refers to Jesse as, quote, a slut bitch of a wife.
Well, that was unexpected. Kind of. Everyone else loves her and misses her and...
And he did for the first half of that speech until he remembered his brother had a job.
This is a lot. There is so much family therapy and personal therapy needing to be done here.
Oh my God. Yeah. So how are you feeling?
Oh my goodness.
And Sam and Max verbally battle for a while and then Sam leaves. Silence. Max then seems to give his blessing to Teddy about their marriage. Ruth then commands some tension somehow and suggests that she had something of a different life before she met Teddy.
Oh, no. Come on, Ruth. Be more specific.
So what we know is they've been married for 6 years. He's a professor of philosophy. And she's the professor's wife in America.
Yeah.
Okay. That's kind of a cush life if you think about it.
Yeah, sure.
But she's kind of enjoying this little... fracas and wanting to see just how far things are going to go. And then after that revelation of that she had a different life, there's some sparring between Teddy and Lenny about his prowess as a professor, in the middle of which Teddy's cigar goes out.
Okay.
Come on, Pinter. Great symbolism there.
Yes.
Your cigar isn't as powerful as the other men's. Okay. Soon, Ruth suggests to everyone in the room that she's somewhat happier here than she is in America. I think she refers to it as like there's rocks everywhere and insects. There's insects everywhere. But she likes it here.
Yeah. She likes it here where she's currently enjoying this very, very strong undercurrent of status play.
Mm-hmm. And upon this piece of information, Max, Lenny, and Joey all leave. And Teddy implores his wife that they should leave at once. He indicates that at one point she was a, quote, photographic model for the body. And that he didn't care about that. He just wanted to take her home. Ruth denies him and Teddy goes to pack their things. Lenny comes back in and begins speaking with Ruth about the types of clothes she likes to wear, as it'll be winter soon and a new wardrobe will be necessary. She reveals to him that she was a model at one point. So you're like, wait a minute, you were both, okay, photographic model for the body. What does that mean exactly?
Yeah.
You
know, yeah.
Were you a still nude artist or, yeah. You know, like an anatomy book? I don't know.
I don't know. I like my brain is genuinely like, what would that mean? Because like I do photography and I'm like, but what would that mean if my model was a body model? I would just think it's like abstract or like, mm-hmm. like you said, nude photos.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is very beautiful and wonderful. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Now Teddy returns and expresses concern about just what Ruth may have revealed about herself or their lives to his brother Lenny. Then it really hits the fan, Suzanne.
Oh my God. It just now? Because it feels like it's been spinning up there for a while.
Lenny kisses Ruth on the lips with his father and two brothers in the room. He twirls her over to Joey, saying she's wide open, at which point she lays down on the sofa under Joey. While the two of them make out on the sofa, Lenny sits on the arm of the sofa and plays with Ruth's hair.
Wait, what?
And she is not fighting back at all.
I don't know what's happening.
I know. Okay.
I want to know. Keep going, because I don't know how to process this information.
Max then sees Teddy's bags and admonishes his son for wanting to leave so soon.
I mean, I get it.
Stick around.
Like, not again.
Looks like she's having a good time.
Yeah, that's, I don't, what's happening? Oh my gosh.
Teddy then admits he didn't want to introduce his wife to the family as he was ashamed that he married someone beneath him.
Ew.
Max and Lenny reassure him that he's a, quote, broad-minded man, and that he's made a happy woman out of Ruth. At which point, Joey and Ruth roll off the sofa, taking their makeout to the floor.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so first off, let's just take that bit about him saying beneath him. That's bullshit. Let's take that off the table. However, it does seem that maybe she would like to be in a non-monogamous relationship and he would like to be in a monogamous relationship, and there is a lack of communication and it is just playing out in a family room. Literally a family room.
Yes.
Oh, Ruth and Teddy, we need some communication.
Soon, Ruth springs up and starts demanding food and drink, and Lenny and Joey try to appease her requests to little success.
Oh.
Ruth then asks the men if they've read Teddy's collected published works, and after he attempts and fails to defend himself, Ruth takes Joey upstairs.
Oof.
Mm-hmm.
Ruth has got all the power.
2 hours later,
oh my goodness,
Joey comes back downstairs, frustrated that Ruth refused to, quote, go the whole hog.
Oh, I feel really bad for Joey, you know. What a shame.
Bummer.
We really were pulling for you.
You didn't just get sex handed to you. Oh, yeah. You poor thing.
Yeah, with your brother's wife, yeah.
With your sister-in-law.
Yeah, your sister-in-law, who you just met.
And after Ruth refuses to go the whole hog, there's some further manly talk about, I've heard some men can do it without going the whole hog. It's okay. Oh God. Now, with Ruth out of the room, the men sit down to talk business. In this interchange, it is revealed that Lenny is actually a low-level pimp and that prostitution may have just been the family business all along. And all of Max's chat about being a butcher may have just been for show for Ruth.
Oh, whoa.
So he could present himself as something of a legitimate businessman while still talking about, I had to travel the country to find different types of meat.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. And Teddy is just like, I wanted to do something different.
I want to go home.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
They discuss that they have not had a woman in this house for so long and that Ruth would be a wonderful addition to the home. But They suggest that she may have to pay her way in their employ. Teddy is still insistent on going home, but not before suggesting that he could inspire some American business to come visit his family and enjoy their amenities.
Okay.
He's going to be the American connection.
I got that. I'm like, what? I don't want any part of this.
But
I may just, however, have a connection to bring over if you guys want. Despite me wanting to leave right away.
Right. I don't want any part of this, but I do want my cut.
Yeah, that's why he didn't want to come home, because he knew that the family was just going to suck him back in again.
Right. Every time I try to get out. Ruth re-enters, air quotes, dressed. Teddy informs her that he will be returning to America to their three sons.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh.
He also lets her know the family's plot for her without directly suggesting that they intend to engage her in prostitution. And after a moment, she offers her demands for this proposal, which include her own three-room flat, a maid, and a full wardrobe. After some deliberation, the men all agree to the demands, and Ruth accepts the proposal.
But listen, Ruth is a business person. She's like, if I'm going to do this, I want my own space. I want clothing. I don't want to have to clean up after myself. I want good food. She's like, I got you all excited.
She's a mover and a shaker.
Yeah, she's a modern lady. Yep. Lady, I don't know. I still met this part though of like, are Teddy and Ruth ever gonna? They just don't have a. Okay, this is how they roll. All right, they didn't have a conversation. It was just like, this is what's happening. Okay.
Yep. Teddy says his goodbyes, and as he leaves, Ruth refers to him as Eddie. Not even calling him by his actual name.
Oh my gosh. Teddy. What is happening?
The final tableau is of Ruth sitting comfortably on a chair in the middle of the room with Joey's head in her lap, and she strokes his hair. Max is demanding that Ruth acknowledges that he is not an old man. Ruth ignores his pleas with a number of silences and pauses. The last line of the play is Max demanding that Ruth kisses him. She does not. Lenny just stares at the whole thing. And the curtain drops.
That's right. Ruth was like, Teddy wants me to do all these other things. Like a traditional wife stuff. And I just came into this house and saw that I can rule this roost and have everyone under my command and live the way that I want to live. And she was like, thank you very much. Eddie, you can go home, take care of our children, and I'm good.
Or your children now. Yeah. Yep, I'm out.
That's what I mean. Good luck. Bye.
Oh. Woof. Now, it's my understanding when this came out, it was quite controversial, obviously. Sure. A lot of people were like, I can't believe she's submitting to being a prostitute. And it leaves the question, will she ever? Probably not.
I don't think so. No, here's the thing. This is what her power is, because she has everyone at her fingertips without doing anything.
Right. Exactly.
In that first standoff with Lenny, she completely wins. She diffuses everything with her words.
With a glass of water.
Exactly. Oh. Joey, she takes him upstairs and they don't clearly do it. And then you don't see him being furious about it. He's like annoyed. And then she gets them to an amazing deal for her, which is like, I don't even want to live here with you guys. I need my own place.
Yep.
So, no, I feel like what they've shown is she has the power of words to get what she wants.
Yeah. Ultimately, at the end of the day, I'm like, so what can beat toxic masculinity? Feminine wiles. Mm. That's it.
Yeah. Well, because here's the thing. she's never going to overpower them physically. She can't.
Right.
Like, so no. She's like, I'm going to use the thing that you guys are weak towards, and I'm going to use that to my advantage.
Absolutely.
Game one.
And they're all thinking, boy, it's going to be awesome when we get some of that.
Yeah.
Never going to happen.
Nope.
Never going to happen.
I mean, I can see why. What year did you say? Was it 65? What year?
1965.
1965. It actually makes a lot of sense. And I can see why, one, that it was controversial. Like, but two, I can see why that was a play that was written too, because.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, well, in Britain, you didn't have as strong of a civil rights movement as you did in America.
Yeah.
But that didn't stop people from thinking about it. Like, yeah. You know, there are great plays. I mean, even going back to like A Doll's House, of women just going, no. I don't want to submit to this patriarchy. I'm done.
And here's my question. Does it? It probably doesn't say, but they are coming from America, which means I would assume that she's American?
Oh, no. She's actually British.
She is British.
She's British. And they married in London.
Oh.
But none of the brothers obviously knew about it.
Okay.
And then they just absconded to America, where he taught philosophy at a college.
Okay. So she was just like, keep calm and carry on. And then she moved to the States and she was like, I'm going to be loud now. And I know how to deal with that British male sensibility. I'm going to use a little of this that I learned, a little of that.
And I think it isn't until she finds out about Jesse that she really understands that there is a power to be had here.
Yeah.
This woman had a power over these men.
Yeah.
And they didn't even realize it. They just speak about her in kind words in passing. Yeah. But I think she went, oh, so there is a lack of a feminine presence in this house.
Yeah.
And that can control the world.
Yeah. And you're not, it reminds me of, which is not at all the same in theory it is, but where in My Big Fat Greek Wedding, the first movie where she goes, the man is the head of the household, but the woman is the neck that turns the head.
Yes. Exactly. But in this case, the neck is a prostitute.
Yeah.
Potentially.
Yeah. Potentially.
Wow. Well, I know that there is a production of this going on. I don't know if it's still going on, but I knew it was in January in the UK. And I think it was on the West End. And there was a lot of talk about one of the more unfortunate things that has happened as a result of the pandemic is this whole woke situation where you have people who are like, hey, we're talking about things that should be talked about. And there are things that are in the past that, man, they don't match the standards of today. And I listened to a bit of an interview with the director of that. The interviewer is like, so why are we doing this play, which is so sexually aggressive and so ambiguous about what happens to Ruth at the end? And the guy was like, well, I'm pretty sure it's clear what happens with Ruth at the end.
It feels like for that time that it was very her taking control of something that she was okay with doing. And she was in the power position there. At least that's the way that I walk away with it.
And the director was even saying, like, the thing is, we had auditions. Mm. And the women coming into this, they knew what was going to be asked of them. So they thought it was important enough for this message to still be out there, that toxic masculinity is still a problem. And there may be very easy diffusions to it.
Yeah.
But we have to allow the idea that, you know what, women also can be kind of powerful.
Yeah, women can be powerful. Women, it's like women can also use their sexuality in whatever way they want to. You know, it's like,
yeah.
And again, like I said, 1965, that makes sense. It was like, that's right. I'm not going to be ashamed of this. Like, I want to do this. There's nothing wrong with it because I'm okay with it. And I put you all in your place and got what I wanted.
My listeners, that's the sound of Suzanne punching her fist into her hand.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Adamantly. You know?
Yes. I'm adamantly.
Like, is she slapping herself? What's going on?
No, punching my fist into my hand. That's what I'm doing.
Yeah. But yeah, you go back and you read this play, it's going to be startling. You're like, they did not say this, but this is absolutely what's going on.
Yeah. No, it's so great. You know how sometimes you'll read a play and it takes a couple times to read it to kind of fully take it in. And so what is so great about this is I feel like it's almost like reading it a couple times, getting it under my belt. And now when I read it, I get to walk into the world a little more filled out.
But watch out for the pauses.
Oh, just they're going to be so pregnant. Is it an ellipses? Is it a pause or is it a silence? Because those are three very different ones.
He writes them out very distinctly.
I can't wait.
Like a speech will end and then it just says pause.
Oh my gosh,
and so that I think is so fascinating because it's like an instruction book for the actor.
Yeah.
You know exactly what you're supposed to be doing here.
Oh, yeah. I need you to know now in the future when I read plays again and I see an ellipses, a pause or a silence, I am going to think of you and it's going to make me
feel. Oh, well. I guess I left that wonderful impression.
No, that's awesome. We had this great talk about several types of pregnant pauses and how long you wait with them and which one, you know, what the buildup is.
Put it into a world of sexual tension.
Yes, that's what we did. We did it.
Oh, man. We did it. Pretty fascinating stuff, isn't it? The power of sexual politics completely thrown into disarray with some subtle and some not so subtle techniques. I'd love to hear from you to see what you think is going to happen to Ruth and the family. I'd also like to thank Suzanne Katsakis for her contributions to this episode, and I'll be happy to have her on the show again in the future. But for now, I'll sign off. This has been another episode of Euripides, Eumenides, a Theater History Podcast. I am your host, Aaron Odom. Another episode should be in your ears in 2 weeks, and I will see you at intermission.